Hello, everybody. This is Science Studio, and my name is Keith Pannell. Today, our guest is from the University of Missouri. He's a medicinal chemist, biochemist, one of those sorts of fellows. And his name is Kent Gates. And Kent, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I hope so, because it makes for a good program. Before we get into medicinal chemistry, which I presume is trying to make drugs that will make us all healthy if we get problems, health problems, that is. But how did you become a scientist? What were those formative years? You know, were you told to go to divinity school and rebelled and went into science, or how did it work?
Definitely not that. My parents were always very supportive of science, and I think that the things that really sparked my interest in science was the space program. So I was maybe about, you know, 9, 10 years old when we landed on the moon. And so all of that seemed very exciting, clear that science was making it happen. And the people doing it were sort of, back in the day, scientists looked like heroes.
So, right. Well, that's interesting, because you're a sort of another generation away from people that I used to interview 10, 15 years ago that said it was Sputnik that was the driving force for them. And now you're post-Sputnik, and so the man landing on the moon was the big deal.
Right, no doubt. And you sort of you hope that we might have something like that now.
Well, we'll come to that towards the end of the program. But did that make you think about astronomy or engineering? Or, I mean, okay, a man lands on the moon. You don't immediately think biochemistry or whatever it is you land up doing.
Definitely not. I did read a lot about astronomy when I was that age and sort of inspired by that. But I think at some point I began to realize that I couldn't really deeply understand astronomy without deeply, deeply understanding mathematics. And I didn't feel like that was my strength back in the day. I think I've gotten better at it since, but back in the day, it wasn't what I really enjoyed.
So, but it's still not good enough to understand quantum entanglement, for example.
Right. I think that is definitely true. So I started bending towards sort of the engineering side of things, which was, again, very clear in the space program.
And so how did that sort of develop? You went to school to study engineering?
Yeah. So in high school, I just sort of generically liked science, took my chemistries and physics. As we noted earlier, boys who liked science back in that day thought, engineering, that's good. I'll be able to go to school for a short 4 years and then get a nice job that pays well and do something productive. So that was what I started with, was engineering. I started out with electrical engineering until I hit the first electrical engineering course and realized that drawing these logic diagrams didn't seem interesting at all to me. So I made a big switch to geology.
Oh, tell us about the thought process there. Engineering, I could see, but geology is a big one. I mean, that's outdoors, for goodness sake.
Yeah. Well, I like outdoors, right. But I think the things maybe that sort of tie a lot of these ideas together, perhaps poorly in my mind, but ultimately I sorted it out. It was sort of what intrigued me about electrical engineering was really how semiconductors and the chips worked. I realize now, looking back, that that's really more of a chemical issue than an engineering issue. And of course, the materials like semiconductors, inorganics of various sorts, are not that different from rocks. And so I think
especially if you're interested in silicates.
Yeah, when I look back, I think the common thread was I liked materials, and I liked thinking about the molecular makeup of materials, and geology incorporated that along with being outdoors, which I liked back in the day and I still like. The reason that I ended up actually in chemistry was, for geology, I had to take some additional chemistry courses. And while I was in one of those chemistry courses, I met a girl. And she was also in that chemistry course, and we started studying together. And so we both did quite well in this chemistry course. And she was pre-med at the time, and she said, well, I have to take organic chemistry next semester. Well, I didn't have to take organic chemistry
however,
for geology, but I said, what the heck? I'd like to spend more time with this girl, and we'll keep studying together. So I just enrolled in organic chemistry for that reason. I may be the first person in the world who ever took organic chemistry to get a date or fun. I'm not sure.
Did you land up marrying this young lady?
Yes, so
wonderful.
She is my wife, so that was a good decision.
So she's responsible for your career.
In probably a lot of ways, yes. But certainly in that way. So I was still a geology major, and I went to the chair of the geology department, and I sat down in his office, and I said, I'm really liking this organic chemistry course. Is there any way that this ties into geology? It didn't obviously tie into geology that I'd seen, which was all sort of inorganic materials and minerals and organic molecules, as you know, are really quite a different flavor of molecule. I asked the chair that question, and he sat there and stared at me for an uncomfortably long time and then simply said, nope.
Wow. I mean, I think that gentleman is really culpable. I mean, organic chemistry comes from where? Decomposition under high pressures and temperatures of depositions from the aeons back then.
Looking back, I was naive at the time, or I would have known better. but now, of course, you look at geology and microbiology. It's all interdisciplinary. The
Absolutely.
Chemistry of how minerals are formed and
he was old school geologist.
I think
obviously.
He was old school. Yeah.
Right.
So
never heard of sedimentary deposits. It was all igneous intrusions.
So he simply said no, and I said, "All right, sir." And I got up and left and changed my major that afternoon to chemistry, continued to love the organic chemistry even when my wife stopped loving organic chemistry.
Okay, so tell us. So that was all in Kansas, I believe,
yes,
correct?
I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas, right. And I went to school at Kansas University.
And then graduate school follows inexorably. Where did you go to graduate school?
I went to graduate school in Evanston, Illinois at Northwestern University.
Lovely. And what did you do there?
That was where I sort of started applying the organic chemistry to the medicinal side of things. I worked with a guy named Rick Silverman, who wasn't necessarily super famous at the time that I worked with him, but he was working on studying the chemical mechanisms by which drugs inactivate enzymes. So as you know, a lot of our pharmaceuticals, things like aspirin, are molecules that block the action of some enzyme, and by doing that, we can modulate various physiological functions. And he was studying the chemistry of how that happened. In the time after I left the lab, he's become much, much more famous because while I was in the lab, they discovered the compound Lyrica. And unfortunately, I was not part of that project and wasn't on the patent with him.
What a pity.
He's now a very, very rich man and has built a new building for Northwestern.
Tell the audience and myself, what is this molecule again?
So Lyrica, I think it's also called pregabalin. It's if you pay attention now that you know the name Lyrica, you'll see ads for it on television.
It's 11 o'clock at night for a disease that you don't know you've got.
Yeah, it's actually on even in prime time because I think they're pushing it for the treatment of neuropathic pain. So if you had, say, a disease like shingles, which will give you neuropathic pain, which can be really agonizing, and I think there are other sort of just more general symptoms and syndromes of people that have nerve pain.
Okay.
This drug is probably the thing that your MD will push at you.
Or the patient will push on the MD. I mean, that's the whole point of
advertising. Having seen the advertisements, yes.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's something that's uncomfortable about that, but I don't want to get into it on this program. But you just brought up shingles. And that brings up two different ways of treating illnesses, disease, conditions. One is that you take a pill, all right, and hope that modifies your discomfort, at least, or you can get a vaccine. There are vaccines for shingles, right?
Yes.
And so from your particular vantage point, is there enough money being spent on trying to find the vaccine as opposed to pushing on more and more drugs to people?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think so. Shingles is caused by a virus, I think a retrovirus that basically parks its material inside of our cells. And that's viral diseases are amenable to vaccines. A lot of the diseases that we want to treat maybe aren't, at least not in ways that we understand right now. So.
But I mean, here's a classic case where you've got both a treatment, that is this Lyrica, and you've got the possibility of giving people vaccinations.
Yeah, I think in a sense, those end up doing two different things. So the vaccination will really prevent, or is designed to prevent, the kind of the outbreak or the onset of the disease in an individual before it really takes hold. So. That's probably a good thing, right?
Especially, I would think so. I mean,
I think they say if people have had shingles, you know, that they should probably, as they get older, they should probably have this vaccine to prevent an outbreak. The Lyrica really just treats the symptoms. Once you've had the outbreak, Lyrica is just, you know, it's essentially just like a fancy version of taking aspirin
to treat your headache. is in North America, there is a school of thought. An uninformed school of thought that says, you know, that these vaccines are just as likely to give you problems as to solve problems. And I don't know if the scientific community has been outspoken enough to say that this is just medieval thinking.
I think the scientific community is probably never outspoken enough against ideas that they view as crazed and ignorant. I think it's also, of course, that scientists are extremely busy trying to, at least in their minds, push back the frontier of our understanding, and they feel like that's more important than looking backwards and trying to revisit, you know, these scientific ideas that they thought were solved 20 years ago or 50 years ago.
Well, but the problem with that, Kent, is that if you don't, when you're pushing forward the bounds, sometimes look back, it's good to look back and say, well, hang on, society isn't with me. And then you begin to realize that you've got a dual responsibility.
Yeah,
it's absolutely. One thing to move forward the boundaries, but if no one's following you, that is societally, it's a problem.
Yeah, I agree. I think essentially sort of you get out there on your own, doors close behind you, and you realize, uh-oh, I'm alone. And there's no support financially, governmentally, and societally anymore. So I think scientists really have to work harder to do that. It is hard to identify the mechanisms for that. You know, it's, at this point, it's basically individual heroes that go out and work those channels.
And sometimes they get not much approbation from the scientific community.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest is Kent Gates from the University of Missouri. And when we come back, we'll find out what Kent Gates is doing in his research laboratory these days. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Hey, Dave, do you know what's responsible for half of all hospital deaths in America?
I don't know. Heart failure?
No, it's sepsis.
Ah, of course. Sepsis is when the body's immune system overreacts to an infection and begins attacking its own organs and tissues.
But it's possible scientists have identified the biomarker that can predict who's at risk of dying from sepsis so doctors can intervene earlier.
Sepsis can be triggered by any kind of an infection, including viruses, bacteria, fungi, and parasites. Very early in sepsis, the immune system produces large amounts of various proteins to ramp up the immune response. One is a powerful process called pyroptosis, which destroys infected cells.
But it also fuels the development of sepsis. When scientists look for genetic variations that made people more susceptible to pyroptosis, they identified a single change in DNA that creates a molecule called methylthioadenosine, or MTA.
Scientists hypothesized that MTA levels can predict who would die of sepsis, and changing its levels can increase survival. Early in infection, its level in the blood goes up, but falls in tissues. But if an infection isn't dealt with, more MTA is released, which indicates an out-of-control immune system.
Indeed, in 62 patients, the chances of dying from sepsis were increased over 7 times when MTA levels were doubled.
But in their experiments with mice, those treated with MTA before a bacterial infection lived longer. The key is to find out when to raise and lower MTA levels during sepsis to improve survival.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Kent Gates from the University of Missouri. And Kent, we were talking about your training, some of the ideas about, you know, getting small molecules to treat all sorts of diseases. What are you doing right now? What's your big, what's the bee in your bonnet in terms of research and your application perhaps even?
Well, the questions that we've been looking at recently are really quite fundamental in that there are no obvious therapeutic agents, drugs, vaccines that lie on the horizon.
No patents, no startup companies.
No,
man, you're failing.
Darn it. We're just asking pretty fundamental questions, but we still believe that asking fundamental questions ultimately can open the pathways to treatments and diagnoses and good things like that. So what we've been looking at is damage to the DNA or the genetic blueprint in human cells. And it turns out that the DNA in our cells is subject to kind of internal damage at every moment of every day, that there are literally thousands of the letters of our genetic code that are being damaged and possibly mutated. And those changes in our genetic code can lead to diseases like cancer, maybe neurodegeneration, possibly this kind of DNA chemistry can be involved in the aging process as well. So we've been looking at a particularly important type of damage where the two strands of the double helix become essentially welded together. So if you think about, almost everybody can imagine the kind of...
Sorry, but by welded together, you mean like
covalently,
fixed together.
Yeah, covalently
so
bonded.
So they can no longer unravel into
exactly,
individual strands.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So if we... almost everybody out there can probably imagine that kind of iconic image of the double helix. It looks like a spiral staircase, and the two railings of that spiral staircase in that DNA image that we see all over biotechnology and biochemistry textbooks are the two strands of the genetic code. In order for the DNA to the genetic code, which is sort of the sequence of bases that make up the stairs of that spiral staircase, in order for that code to be read and function in the cell, the two strands have to be pulled apart. And so these covalent crosslinks where those two strands become welded together essentially blocks the function, all of the functions of DNA. And there's good evidence that there are endogenous or just internal sources of those kinds of DNA crosslinks and that they very well may be involved in the kind of damage that causes cancer and aging. But nobody actually knows what the chemical makeup of those crosslinks is.
You mean today you can't tell me where is the covalent link? Is it from one base to another or one sugar to another?
We can't really say almost anything about it except that we're pretty sure that they exist in cellular DNA of humans and other mammals and all organisms. We know that they're there. We don't know anything about sort of the chemical structure of the linkage. We don't know what the exact chemical cause of it is, and we don't know where it is in the DNA. So
then, just if I might back up for a moment, when was it that we first recognized that there were these potential welded nucleic acid species, fragments?
That's a good question, and it comes from sort of indirect data, but it's really still quite compelling. And so I have to sort of back up a step and maybe make people feel a little bit better about some of the things that I've said. So I said this horrific thing that our genetic code is being assaulted by chemicals. It's being damaged and the letters of our code are being changed.
Minute by minute.
Minute by minute, we're just degrading and dying. So it sounds really, really horrible. But fortunately, inside of our cells, we have repair systems that are able to patch a lot of this damage back up. And these repair systems exist because the damage exists, of course. These repair mechanisms had to evolve so that an organism could have a genetic code that remains stable over time. Well, so to this idea of crosslinks. So it turns out that there are elaborate crosslink repair mechanisms that have been evolved and retained across almost all walks of life, from bacteria to fungus to mammals to humans. And these are again, very elaborate. These are systems that require probably 50 proteins or more. So these are machines of protein complexes that are able to unhook these crosslinks, remove the damages.
As a unit species.
Yes. They work in tandem, not necessarily all grouped together at the same time, but in sort of an orchestrated ballet where they will unhook the damage, remove the damages, and then patch back in as best they can the genetic code. So it's one of the best pieces of evidence for the existence of these crosslinks is the evolution and retention of these elaborate crosslink repair systems. We simply wouldn't have them if we weren't generating crosslinks essentially as sort of the price of doing business as a living cell or a living creature.
So it's like in the future that somebody will find a magnifying glass and say, ah, there must have been crime. All right?
In a sense, yes.
Right. I like it.
Yes. Yeah, so we know these things exist, but we don't know much about them. But we feel like understanding their occurrence and understanding maybe how differences – there almost certainly are genetic differences, for example, between you and me. And those genetic differences may affect the way that we are able to repair or withstand these crosslinks. And it may lead to the ability to predict better how we're going to age and how we're going to be at risk for diseases like cancer or neurodegeneration. And then, of course, we always ultimately hope that once we identify risks, we can identify treatments that might mitigate that risk.
So let's be a little specific, if we could, without losing me and then the audience also. Give me an example of some of the work that you have done or are in the middle of doing and what you have discovered in this quest for trying to think about blended or welded or stuck together DNAs.
Yeah, that's a good question. The specific line of work that we've been pursuing recognized that I would say the most common endogenous damage that's present in DNA, which is a damage where just a single letter or a single one of the nucleic acid bases pops off of the backbone. So there's just one gap on the DNA. That is the most common type of damage that DNA suffers.
Is that called a point mutation?
That would lead to a point mutation.
Right.
It's the specific event is called a deprionation, but that's just sort of language for the biochemists. Now, those are very common. Our cells, the measurements that have been made so far say that every cell in normal living tissue carries between 50 and 200,000 of these damages at steady state, just kind of operating level. So there's a lot of these things around. Now, they're subject to repair, as I indicated already, and so that's good. But we discovered that this very common lesion at a low level can forge interstrand crosslinks. So they can weld to the other strand and make these linkages that prevent the DNA strands from separating and being read.
Now, do you discover that by creating them and then looking at the properties, or you found them just by searching for them?
We discovered it based on kind of purely chemical ideas. We had been working with some compounds that generated these missing base sites, and we were looking at what was known about their chemistry. And at some point, we recognized that they had the chemical potential to reach across and form a bond with the opposing strand. And then we did exactly what you said. We generated synthetic fragments of double-stranded DNA, just chemical mimics of what's present in the cell, generated those missing base sites in them, and then measured their ability to reach over to the other strand and permanently form a cross-link or a bond.
So this was both in the laboratory and via computer modeling?
That's right. At the beginning, when we asked sort of we thought first about the chemistry of these missing base sites and said that they're reactive. They may be able to react with the opposing strand. Then we did exactly as you suggest. We looked at models of DNA. The structure of DNA is, in general, is pretty well known, and we asked whether the distance was appropriate for them to reach across, and we realized that at certain sites it looked like the reach would be possible, a fairly small stretch. And it turned out, gratifyingly, that those reaches were exactly as predicted by the models, that those are the sites and the distances that you get the crosslinks to form.
So having made that discovery, what's the logic for the next step? And we just got a couple of minutes left.
Well, now that we know, we have at least one idea of sort of the chemical face of what we're looking for in these crosslinks, now along with a collaborator at UC Riverside, Yinsheng Wang, we're using mass spectrometry techniques to actually look for these things in living cells. And he has some preliminary data showing that they actually are present in the DNA of living cells in culture. We haven't been to animals or people yet.
No, no. But, I mean, and once you do find evidence for them in cells, living cells, then you think about repairing, I presume, is the next logic.
Right. We'd like to understand.
So you've got a career for the rest of your life.
Mechanisms
anyway.
Of how they're repaired. We even actually have some strategies of how to use FDA-approved pharmaceuticals, compounds that already exist in the clinic, to possibly block the formation of these things.
All right. Well, that sounds promising.
We'll cure aging. we probably won't, but we'll think about how.
Just before we leave, you mentioned your wife was pre-med. Did she go into medicine in the end, and do you discuss your work with her in a medical sense?
She did not go into medicine. She took a degree, a BA in chemistry, but then she went to law school.
Ah,
she
okay.
practiced law for a few years, and now she is a law professor who studies freedom of speech.
Well, Kent, that's very interesting. So she got you into chemistry because she had a goal. She changed her mind and left you saddled with the chemistry.
Absolutely. But I'm happy with it.
No, absolutely. Kent Gates, University of Missouri, medicinal chemist, biochemist. It's been a lot of fun talking to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
I'd like to thank Lauren Terrasas for being the producer for this program. And thank you, the listener, for being there. And we will see you next week on another Science Studio. Bye-bye.